best use of family and work.
There are some very nice young people now well into their 20s, and young people who are a little younger. A trend has occurred, at least in this area. There are different trends in different areas, but the tendency is to finish high school, to get married as soon as possible, and to take the most convenient job that is available. Essentially, a certain indifference in planning. Now, this arose not altogether as a result of the faulty thinking of some families or young people in this matter. It happened to have begun, of course, about a decade ago, when some students came to our college when it was under an entirely different administration. Sometimes they stuck it out for a semester. One young fellow was there for 1 week and simply decided this was not for him. Now, that's not true today, but for some young people, it takes a long time to forget it. And what older brothers or sisters thought, younger brothers and sisters are likely to continue to think. Then there was another area outside of this country where I have mentioned young people generally don't know quite what they should do, and they stay on unemployment. You go downtown, and of course you see a certain prosperity, you see a certain creativity, and you ask who does it, and here are immigrants learning English, who are actually the heart and core of some of the development taking place. It isn't just the money that they have, it is creative ideas. And this brings to light, of course, a fault that I think we should acknowledge, and I want to acknowledge this evening. Now, it's a fault not in the sense that what we said was an error, but in the sense that what we said was not the whole story. I think you'll catch it right away. We've said in the Plain Truth magazine that the question of getting a job in times of inflation or times of recession is a critical matter. And so we've published articles, not necessarily the one that I have in mind by name here, but a number of them. This was the theme, how to get and hold a good job. Now, there's nothing wrong with acquiring and holding a good job. But there is a premise in that that is partially true, but not altogether true. The premise is that all you can do is to find a job, but somebody else was creative enough to think of the job. So what we really need to consider, and what I want to, in a sense, focus on this evening, is why should you merely look for the job? Why shouldn't you create the job? Probably the most characteristic person fulfilling this was Joseph. You remember the story. Pharaoh had some trouble with two of those who served him most closely. You know, commonly people would be invited to the Pharaoh's palace, shall we say. They would be discussing special things, and there were two people, the one who sipped and the one who ate a bit to be sure that there was no poison for Pharaoh. And apparently something did upset either Pharaoh or his guests. And so there were in prison the chief butler and the chief baker. And there was Joseph. You remember the story of the dreams. And it turned out that one of them was restored, the other was not. Time went by, and the one who was restored forgot Joseph. Pharaoh then had a dream, and Joseph was called, because the other man recalled his thoughtlessness, and Joseph was prepared to appear before Pharaoh and gave him the explanation. Now, what is interesting about the story is, after he explained the dream, he didn't wait for Pharaoh to think up a job. He told Pharaoh exactly what needed to be done in this case. You know what Joseph did? He created a job for himself. Pharaoh said, well, anybody who can think up a solution like that is a fellow who ought to manage the program. So I think in this sense, I have not found, and in talking with some, I don't think we've found a better illustration in the Bible in terms of a person who could give the right advice at the right time or was immediately spotted as the right person for this new responsibility. It's a very important thing to be able to understand how to create jobs for others. Now, of course, in the work, we don't often think of it this way, although Mr. Armstrong did for many years. He realized he was not only responsible for doing a job that Christ had assigned him, but in a sense he was also responsible for creating jobs for many whom God was calling, and some few loyal people who were not being called, but who, especially from the beginning of the college here, I think we can never forget the marvelous contribution our music department made for so many years. The leaders in it were never called, to our knowledge, but one can say it was one of those departments from which we had no disloyalty and no defections. And Mr. Armstrong was always concerned that there was the continuity so that someone wouldn't suddenly be out of a job who had come out here and had moved and given up what otherwise would have been a good occupation where he or she might have been before. This question of creativity, this question of thinking what we ought to do, both for the work and for the good of the family, is a very important thing. Now, in a certain sense, perhaps this is the one area of the work where this subject is least needed. Maybe New York is another, where most everybody is employed, and rather creatively. But in another sense, either in Big Sandy or here would be the two most important places to cover a topic like this, or at any of the cities where the headquarters offices are around the world. Because here is where you go out from to the other areas. Here's where students are who go elsewhere. Here, on this occasion, is where individuals are in from the refreshing program from many areas around the world and are going elsewhere. So I thought it was important to address this topic because the local minister himself and his wife felt it was the most significant problem that they had the most difficult time with, in the sense that it sometimes is easier to counsel people and make specific changes in their lives, but it's a lot more difficult to try to follow somebody through in terms of employment, see that he's or she is really doing the maximum that can be done. There are some people, of course, who are very positive about their skills and abilities, and others are very negative. There are some people who know they have limited ability, and they have limited ability. There are some people who have good ability and think they don't have it. Then there are others who, in a sense, think they have certain skills and don't. So it is important that we take an assessment of our own talents, shall we say, our own drive and determination. And we must distinguish, of course, the fact that some people are more talented than others, and then there are others who are, let's say, perhaps not gifted with talent, but what they have is an ability to simply do work with zeal and determination and loyalty. That is, they have aspects of character, but perhaps no specific creative artistic skills. Maybe they might be defined essentially as more intellectual than necessarily talented. And talents can run in all sorts of areas. Now, one of the factors that we must bear in mind is this. It's very common to make decisions about our future on the basis of how long we think we're going to benefit from what we do. Some people say, I don't want to go to college, 4 years of my time wasted. Who knows? I mean, I may not be here for more than 1 or 2 years. We don't know when the work is going to end, so why waste my time there? Well, may I remind you, this is 1987, and this is February 6th, and it's about over. I was addressing this question in somewhere around February and March in 1979, when some people thought that we were about to leave in March or April, because the devil had come down with great wrath and it was all over. And some, of course, would right now be approximately 8 years in the wilderness waiting for the church to come. And that's a big chunk of one's life. So let's learn a lesson from the last war. I doubt that most of you, the Great War, World War II, I doubt that most of us would want to be around unnecessarily long. That is, I think we'd be willing, in general, to give up in a critical period of time facing the nation if God shows that the work is finished, the doors are closed, and in fact we are asked to get out, whatever the circumstances may be. I doubt that most people would want to stay behind. The longer we wait, of course, the more likely we will find that about half will want to stay behind, but that's another matter. My point is that at this moment, I don't think that's the question. Rather, the question is that we often don't see the long-range benefit of making solid decisions that can be useful. So let me just illustrate a point. If we develop our skills, make good judgments in our decisions, we are benefiting our family, ourselves of course, and we're also benefiting the work. The unemployed are essentially not able, I didn't say willing, but not able to do their full part in the support of the work. Prayer, perhaps, yes, but that's a part only of the responsibilities we have. Now, right now, it would be good to take a look at circumstances. It's one thing if you came to be converted in 1985 or 86, and it may seem very short term. But we really need to look back. When we were first thinking of where we might be and how much work there was to do, this goes back very clearly to 1953. That's when it became apparent that there was quite a bit of work to do. And another 19 years to 1972 seemed a long, long time. There were 18 years, and there were 17 years, and there were 16 years, and it just still seemed a long time, and 15 years, and 14 years. But you know, between 72 and 87 is another 15 years ago. Another 15 years ago. That is, we were wondering 34 years ago how much time God would enable us to work while it is day. 34 years is practically half a lifetime of most men, even in the industrial world. And that represents, for practical purposes, nearly the skilled lifetime of most workers on a job. Now let's look at the world scene around us. Mr. Tkach would certainly tell you, we don't know whether it's going to be over a year or two or five from now. But we can know something. Let me explain it this way. If you're willing not to fall in love with whatever money you have, whatever property you have, whatever relationships you have in this world, if you're able to see clearly what you're willing to give up, then you needn't have concern about doing a little long-range planning successfully. Let's say that that should be our state of mind, and we must start from that premise. Now, we also know accidents can happen on the world scene. Something utterly unforeseen may occur. As of 1987, we could say that such accidents have not occurred since 1972, or for the last 15 years, or since 1953, for the last 34 years. Accidents could happen, something unexpected. The 1929 stock crash, without that, there would never have been the rise of Adolf Hitler to power in Germany in 1933. And we wouldn't have had the crisis develop as it did. An unforeseen accident could happen. Now, the scripture says it will. Something totally unforeseen, focusing in on Jerusalem, which will become a stone of stumbling for all nations, centering primarily on the Temple Mount. That's an accident that's going to happen. There might even be a preliminary one that focuses on the world debt problem, the next most serious thing, and of course the first most likely to occur as an accident. But one doesn't know when the accidents occur. Then there wouldn't be accidents, you would know. In the meantime, it is advisable that we take a look at what is being planned. As of now, the new German election, 1987, means that the German nation in Europe, for example, anticipates the maintenance of its present political policies for another 4 years to 1991. It doesn't mean they plan to change later, but it means that they have accepted that there's another 4 years and they don't anticipate any major change. They wanted it to stay essentially stable. You've been hearing about the Single European Act, that which will be the most important single piece of legislation to create the European Union, dealing essentially at this point yet with minor decisions in which nations give up a certain sovereignty. And that is to come into force in 1992. That essentially is 5 years from now. So from the point of view of the very area of the world that is likely to be the most difficult area for this country to deal with, they do not anticipate any major change for the next 4 to 5 years, and within that time they anticipate taking the first tentative step in nearly 40 years of an attempt to have a certain European Union. It's taken that long. Now, once a child is able to take a first tentative step without falling, the others come much faster. You know, then it's much more rapid. So we're not saying the next step will be 40 years later. That should be clear. But what we're aware of, and it's very important, is that Europe is not rushing to judgment. Europe is taking deliberate steps because there are wise and understanding, and perhaps not always quite so wise and understanding, men and women who are moving toward the solution of the conflicts that have beset Europe for so long since nationalism arose. One can hardly say, unless one is from Argentina, that Britain is led by a woman with no wisdom. One can hardly say that the socialist leader in France is without wisdom. He certainly is a man of some judgment to make decisions that don't carry France too far in some unusual direction. One can say Chancellor Cabbage of Germany, that's his name, you know, Chancellor Kohl. Well, Chancellor Cabbage, that's an interesting thought, isn't it? Anyway, he is a man of significant stability. Without any question, he has given guidance to the nation. He is not one of the flamboyant individuals, but he is in charge. He likes to be in charge, for that matter. He said so. And he has a command. And, you know, it's amazing from year to year. There are people who said, well, he won't be in there. He's going to be kicked out, this one scandal, that scandal. He can't stay. But all the people who were saying these things, who were they? He's just been reelected for another 4 years. That is in terms of the way the parliamentary system operates in Europe as distinct from our system. Choosing the party, and in that sense he's the head of the party, so it wasn't a direct vote. It was a logical conclusion of their political system. Well, this gives you some idea. The Soviets, of course, have long-range views, and perhaps they've always been a little slow in getting there. They have said long ago, we first, in order to get at the United States, must in some way have brought Asia under our, let's say, jurisdiction, in the sense that we have a certain measure of control over their trade, their political decisions, their internal policies. It isn't a matter of occupying them, but of bringing them into line as cooperative countries. Then the next most important step must be the acquisition of the geographic position of the Republic of South Africa. I'll never forget there are problems down there of another nature. I'm not addressing the internal social problems. I would only tell you that the Soviet Union knows that if it cannot control the southern tip of Africa, it is not yet prepared to put the final pressure on the United States. And anyone in South Africa knows how far away the Soviet Union is from achieving that goal. It's closer than it was 10 years ago. But the South Africans are also more aware of what the Soviet Union has in mind for the area. The purpose is to throttle Europe and the United States in order that next Central America should pass to the Soviet orbit, which means that the Soviet Union, in a sense, controls its back, Asia, controls South Africa, which is the route from the oil of the Persian Gulf area around. In that sense, you have to control both the Suez and South Africa, which means that you can sooner or later throttle Europe. That's the purpose. Not to invade, but to throttle it. Most people don't realize that the Soviets' buildup in Europe is not in anticipation of a sudden invasion, but to use it as a political threat to keep Europe cowed. Having remembered what the French did in the days of Napoleon, what the Kaiser did, what Hitler did, and what all the countries joined with them did. Again and again and again. And they have to control Central America because we are a two-ocean country, and the loss of the canal, the loss of direct access beyond Mexico, having to, in a sense, go around Cape Horn, would be a disaster for this country if we didn't have access to Central America. These are choke points. Now, the Soviet Union is not yet ready to take them all. And I think we should be realistic. Somebody just wrote me a letter, a member from another continent, who was visiting a third continent, and he said, I admittedly was wrong when I thought it would all end up in 85. And I said, I made another mistake when I thought it would be all over in 86. But now I'm quite sure it's going to be all over in 87. And he thinks it will be shortly after the feast. I'll merely say that in some 1988 Bible study, we may refer to this fact. But it illustrates a very good point. Mr. Armstrong told, he didn't say these things all his life, but he realized it in the last 2 weeks of his life, that God indeed had asked him to lay the foundation, but another man was to continue the work of the building of the superstructure. Now it's going to take much less time. Took Mr. Armstrong 52 years to work on that foundation. I wouldn't anticipate from any realistic view that I have of the world scene anything that is likely to be more than half the time, and very likely less. Nevertheless, that is not something that we can carelessly treat and say, well, I'll just simply get the best job I can and do what little I can and let somebody else pull his load, or my load as well. We need to realize that if we have 1, 2, 5, 10 or more years, how well we handle our skills and guide young people in primary grades, junior high school into college or junior college if they don't come to Ambassador. All these things need to be carefully evaluated so that our young people will prove to be successful. We have, of course, the remarkable experience that as a teacher, I had students in college in the early 1950s whose children have already graduated, who are married, and themselves may have children today. A whole generation has gone by. And we still are capitalizing on what we did in those days when we could. Now, for those who are still in school when the work is over, fine. They've done what they could in the period of time, and if God decides that the sun has set and the night has come, that is His choice. But we cannot be neglectful, and I think it is very important that we think of this in terms of ourselves as grandparents or parents or young people, relatives, encouraging one another to make wise choices and decisions in the lives of those who have education before them or who can rethink opportunities in the field of employment, because there is a lot of change in that area. So, at this stage, we do not anticipate, at this moment, the sudden collapse of the debt market, which could be an economic disaster. I say this because if we have a superstructure to build and we are just beginning the impact of television in Europe, it really doesn't make sense that we get one fraction of a wall up and God calls that the building. I think you should analyze the areas of the world in which things must yet be done. Much more can be done in Europe, West and East. Only some things can be done in Africa by nature of the infrastructure, the lack of transportation or an effective postal system. Many areas of Asia simply will remain waiting for the kingdom of God. I would like to cite again that some areas of the world like that have not even an access to a book that's called the Bible. They, in many ways, may be closer to the kingdom of God than we realize, just like that Roman soldier had more faith than anyone in Israel, Jesus said. I received a very delightful letter that wasn't... Yes, it was a letter as well as a note. Two things. From Sri Lanka, from the Buddhist scholar at the Puravena school where one of our men is teaching. I have mentioned him before. He's the man who pointed out that from his point of view, one of the most important verses he had seen in the gospel, excuse me, was Jesus' statement, "Think not that I am come to destroy the law and the prophets. I am not come to destroy, but to fulfill." Now, here is a man who is a Buddhist scholar, and he knows something of the Worldwide Church of God, the Ambassador Foundation, Ambassador College, and he was talking with our man there. This was in a letter from him, which followed a letter from the young man himself, who had told me about it as well. But in closing, I thought this was a beautiful statement. I'll try to quote it generally. He said, "And I pray that you will remain in the grace of Lord Jesus Christ." That's a Buddhist writing. Now, I get other letters from Christians. "I don't want your magazine anymore." Now, this man, by contrast, says, "You will note I'm sending you two more copies of our Buddhist publication. And it says on there, free of charge." He said, "I learned that from you. That's right. That's the way to do it." Now, he's got the way. We must add the truth and the light. That's all. But, you know, there is a man who wouldn't find it that difficult to take the next step. So you see, there are areas of the world that we don't anticipate the same things that we do in Europe. People who don't have full access to the book, but who remarkably have never stumbled over many things that the Christian world has stumbled over, or for that matter, the Jewish world. But we see that there are certain areas of Africa where significant work can be done. Spots in Asia. We're just beginning in Japan, for instance. But in Europe, it's amazing what still could be done. But it cannot take the same amount of time that it took in North America or the British Commonwealth. So we will have to see. There's certainly work that can be done in Latin America yet to announce the message that Jesus himself brought. We have much more that can be done there. So from a certain point of view, Mr. Armstrong has told us that there is enough work that it's unthinkable that we can all finish it in a month, or for that matter, a year. When you see that, and then when you see the slow, deliberate steps being taken by the opposite superpower and by the Europeans in terms of step-by-step unity, when you see still the minuscule views of certain ones in Israel who are most likely to ultimately tip the scale, they don't represent more than a fraction, in a sense, of the tiniest fraction of the country at this point in time. From that perspective, therefore, we really do need to get to work while it is day. And we can best get to work by being trained for our responsibilities. So let us now focus in on some particular points that should hopefully be helpful in conveying encouragement to others. Some of us underestimate our abilities. Some of us, fewer hopefully, overestimate them. In my judgment, I'm not as concerned about those who overestimate. They soon should learn a lesson. I'm concerned about those who underestimate, where it is difficult to get into their minds, men or women, how much more they could actually achieve. We've said many a time, it's a lot easier to sit on somebody who overestimates himself or herself, than it is to prop somebody up who underestimates himself or herself. And I mention men and women in this sense because in our society there are many opportunities for women today in the 80s and into the 90s that were not here in the 50s. Not that all these opportunities are good, but the reality is that there's no use sitting in an apartment with four walls. If you're a woman, there may be things that really could be done and should be done. And, of course, we have some very fine, creative women in the work. So the first thing is to recognize that you ought to consider whether you are really fully understanding your abilities or whether you are, let's say, denying some of the skills and abilities you have. Do you push yourself? Solomon tells us a lot in the book of Proverbs about pushing oneself on to achieve. And wisely, not to accumulate money, that's not what we're talking about here, but to develop ourselves as a person and to make the spin-off, which might include money, responsibility, public image and character, all for the benefit of one's own family and friends, others who are in need, and most of all, the work. You remember the parable. The person who hid his talent in the napkin was not the fellow who was given 10. Not the fellow who was even given 5, but the person who was given 1. So now let's finish this thought here and point out that sometimes the person who may have by nature less of the abilities or opportunities, on the basis of this parable, is likely to be the first one who does the least with it. That is, there is something in human beings that the more skills and abilities you have been given or have acquired, the more you like to use them. But people who are limited often shirk responsibility. There is an area that is very important, not to shirk responsibility. Many young people out of high school today think of themselves as having one talent. I can't do this, I can't do that, I've got no money. Well, the fact remains, you don't compare yourself with a person who's been working for 25 years and it took him 25 years to get what he has or what she has, so that now some things can be done. A very important evaluation needs to be made by anybody who has completed the pre-collegiate education to sit down and to analyze whether, let's say, you're somebody who should simply take the nearest and best job that's available, or whether you should become more creative and analyze whether academic pursuits are important, whether non-academic pursuits, whether job experience, whether non-job experience is more important. That non-job experience is often associated with sometimes night school. It isn't directly related to the job, and it isn't directly academic, but where you can get some other training. So we'll focus in at the moment on this area as one of those areas in which, in this case, young people often underestimate themselves. We must not underestimate ourselves. And of course, there are older individuals who have regularly underestimated their abilities. Now, from here, we should ask ourselves, what is it that makes some people simply want to do what somebody else tells them? And how is it that some people can succeed by being their own bosses? Well, that's an experience that perhaps we have to go through. We need to analyze ourselves. Perhaps we need to analyze our family and what others in the family have done. There was a time this was not such a question. When most people lived out in the country, almost everyone was in a sense self-employed. Most farmers have been self-employed. Now they're being reduced to a great extent simply as workers for the bank or workers for a great agribusiness. But as people drifted into the city, more and more drifted into that area that we simply call doing hourly wage work. There are some who are in management who might be on salary. Now, right now, there is a new shift in the area of what we call services, where people can be self-employed. Mr. Armstrong took a test years ago, you remember, and analyzed his strengths and his weaknesses. Now, that test perhaps is interesting. Today it certainly could be of some interest, but much more has been learned. Some things have been unlearned, too, unfortunately. But there is no doubt that it wouldn't hurt us to take some kind of self-examination to see where our abilities are. That's just good common sense. You might find that relatives generally proved more successful at one thing than another. And with that in mind, this gives you some idea of what your own skills are likely to be. I've learned to note to what extent our children's skills tend to mirror one side or another of the family. Our children don't have skills that some of you do because our family didn't inherit those particular skills. But they inherited perhaps others. These will vary. And perhaps as an older person, one sees some of these things that one didn't see right out of high school in one's self at that time. But it is certainly worth taking some kind of self-examination test. We're not talking of something costly. And to get the evaluation of others. My wife, when I was talking with her about this, what about counselors? But then first thing that comes to her mind is that our daughter, the youngest one, told my wife in particular, that she was not impressed with a counselor. In that case, she probably was right. But there are counselors that are very helpful. In this case, she had her own mind already made up. She didn't need somebody to tell her what she was willing and able to do. But there are others who don't know what to do, and a counselor is very important to give some kind of guidance. We soon learn that as individuals, we make up our minds about things at different age levels. Some children graduate from high school and don't know what to do. Some young people graduate from college and don't know what to do. And some already wish they were out of junior high so they could do what they want to do. So these are very variable things. We should recognize not to rush out of schooling, but we should also, as the years go by, be able to assess what we could do and what we could do best. We're not asked to develop every single talent. If you lived as long as Adam, you could perhaps devote a century to each. But this is not your time. We simply don't have that kind of time. What we're dealing with is what's the most useful and where can we be the happiest and most effective. It isn't just where the most money comes from. I think that's valuable, but we should not be in a job that we hate. I think that's tragic, and many people are misfits. That's been addressed. Mr. McNair, who's a deputy chancellor over the years, has pointed up the importance of finding that particular area in which you really could do well. There may be other areas you could do well also, but don't get into an area in which you can't do well. Find one in which you can clearly succeed. Now, a counselor can give the kind of advice that may steer you into experiences that will help you make a choice. Sometimes you have to have on-the-job experience. Or you might discover that a job you have clearly isn't what you would want to do. Now, a counselor can give the kind of advice that may steer you into experiences that will help you make a choice. Sometimes you have to have on-the-job experience. Or you might discover that a job you have clearly isn't what you would want to do. There is something to be said about knowing people. I had an interesting discussion. I've mentioned this on occasion some years ago with a man. In this case, he is the... with other people. One of the great things about people who are successful is they like to introduce you to other people who are successful. And what they assume is that you will follow through and profit by that introduction. Now, in the church, we can't follow through on everyone because it's simply too worldly in certain cases, that is, going in the wrong direction. But one would be surprised how often good, responsible contacts are important in terms of being successful in holding down responsibilities. A counselor, a teacher, can steer you in a certain direction. Perhaps family members can steer you who have had opportunities, or they know other people. I believe this is one of the greatest problems that occurs for black men in the inner cities of the United States. The people whom they know are the people, unfortunately, in general, who are in occupations that should never exist, especially with the drug traffic today in the inner city. And it is that absence of contact with people who are succeeding and to see others who are successful on the job, other than in the area perhaps of sports and a few exceptions, that has greatly limited the creative inspiration for young people in the inner cities. I don't know of anything that I can say that's more important than the church could contribute. And that is that if you, as an older person in the congregation, find that a young person is really interesting, that you take some time out and see what that young person, man or woman, would like to do. The church in the Midwest that I spoke of, the minister has a 12-year-old son who has some talent. And there is a man in the church who has an ability and a job in the same general area. And he's working with this young person. Now, his father doesn't have this talent, nor his time. His father's a minister. But this person does have a certain amount of time and is giving him some instruction. I think that is a very, let's say, noble endeavor. Someone who steps out of his normal realm, which is simply taking care of his job and himself, and stepping into the role of giving a young person a certain encouragement. Now, this is something that we could all do, because some of us have some unusual contacts. I know of individuals that certainly can provide, let's say, contacts at some significant level in different fields. Certainly Mr. Tkach could say the same thing. Mr. Armstrong could have said the same thing. You know, with our experience, after decades, we meet people and you like them, you talk things over, they introduce others to you, and you realize that there are opportunities. So it is helpful if we sat down and analyzed in our local congregations what young people are doing and became a little more acquainted with what they would like to do and achieve. I'm somewhat aware, and not fully as much as perhaps I should be, of the creativity of some young people. Certainly, I find it interesting to see what they want to do, and I have encouraged some in certain particular areas where I think I have some knowledge. In an area where I simply have no knowledge, I say, why don't you see somebody else? So there's an area where we can all, within the church, assist, as well as within the world outside, where there are acquaintances and opportunities that lie ahead. The old Greek expression, know yourself, was sometimes misunderstood, but in this sense is very important. You should know yourself. Mr. Armstrong knew himself. He knew his strengths and his weaknesses. Mr. Tkach knows where his greatest strengths are. Mr. Tkach was not trained in advertising. He was trained in other significant areas which explained his management skills. Mr. Armstrong needed those skills less than he needed the advertising skills much more to lay the foundation. So we should all recognize our general abilities and our weaknesses and capitalize on the former. Now, in analyzing what we could do, let us take one of those simple illustrations. In my judgment, most people, even if they had abilities in certain areas, could not exercise them in some because of the conflict between the law of God and the way this world is going. In the world, for a profession, music offers very little, even though many of you may have some significant talent. It's one of the problems that I know has occurred again and again, and that is the problem of performance Friday evening or Saturday. We can encourage young people to do their best, but we must recognize there's some areas that are simply wiser to stay away from. It's wonderful to develop within the church and to use it, but it may not be successful for you to be in such an area in the world in terms of public performance. Then there is the question, let's say, that's less useful for us, but in certain areas it's still important, and that is the question of farming. Now, if there is an area which ought to be one of those God-blessed areas, this certainly should be, and yet it is the one area that most people will never succeed in this present world. It's too late unless you inherit a paid-for ranch. There's no use trying to, but let me just illustrate the point. You also need to have some financial judgment as to whether there's going to be sufficient reward for the efforts put in. There's no use buying expensive land if it's going to cost more to buy the land than the land will produce in agricultural output on the market. Well, that's common sense, and yet many of the farmers did the opposite, who should have known better, who were on the farm. These were not city people who went out into the farm. They knew better. They bought the farm as a write-off. They wanted to lose money. But the farmer should have known better in many cases and expanded with expensive property without realizing that the product produced on the land would never be able adequately to sustain family and debt. Similarly, when we go into business, we need to know that if you do some investing in some small business, that you're really going to get a logical result. So it is very important to have access to information as to what it really costs to be in some areas. And you may simply have to work toward it and not rush. If you have inherited some money, the one thing you don't want to rush into is spend it. And if you haven't, then you work toward it, and you plan and you analyze. Is that an effective area? There are areas in which you can easily make money or lose money. There are areas in which you will never be rich but never be poor. You learn, of course, that in a sense, business is based on the fact of offering services of sufficient worth to the other person that the other person would rather exchange his money for your services than keep the money. That's really what business is based on. And you need to realize that your service should not be merely a cover to get somebody's money, but it should be a service in which what you give is most certainly equal to, if not more, than what would be paid. That is the right way to approach it. There are a number of verses in the Bible that are interesting in this connection. And I thought it might be good to go through a few of the Proverbs as time permits and give us some understanding. There are general aspects of character not always related to job, but there are a few that most certainly would help us in this area. We will bypass at the moment the introduction, which covers the first 9 chapters, and take a look at chapter 10. It starts out in an interesting fashion. A wise son makes a glad father. A foolish son is the heaviness of his mother. Now, these are general statements that we probably would find satisfactory without much further thinking. On the other hand, in terms of earning a living, in terms of jobs, in terms of goals, you want to think about the impact this has. If a son isn't wise, and there's some serious mistakes that he makes, how distracting this can be to father and mother. How much time can be taken trying to correct the mistakes of children, perhaps having to pay for those mistakes financially. It would have been much better to have set the young man or the young woman on the right path in the first place than to try to pick up the pieces afterward. Especially if you have a business, you have perhaps a service that you can render, and not to have someone whom you can trust within the family to do the work. It's wonderful when a father and son situation can occur where a young man can take over and continue the work that the father has done or help expand it, because he profits by his father's experience and goes from there. In a sense, what we learn from this is that if we're really going to be successful in what we do, we must first of all be successful in our child rearing. And therefore, we will be much more successful later, and we won't have the same distractions, the same costly mistakes that unfortunately other bad parents have to pay for, because we have solved it early in life. Let's then move a little further in this. He becomes poor, verse 4, who works with a slack hand. Now, this is a general rule of thumb. The hand of the diligent makes rich, that is, you prosper. Now, we generally have no problem with verse 4 in our understanding. The point of importance is, however, that that's only a part of the story. For instance, if your hand is always diligent, but you never take it off the shovel in the ditch, you're not going to get ahead. There is a time, in other words, not only to be diligent, but to ask, what are you diligent at? Ought you stay with what you're doing? Or should you begin to do something else? And this is where this matter of self-analysis is very important. Now, maybe if you work for somebody else, he will offer you an opportunity. But you must realize whether that opportunity is really going to be profitable. You could be given an opportunity and go in a direction that is soon going to be dead end. You want to analyze whether new opportunities are likely to, let's say, be worth the effort, and not to be in some competitive area where you simply will find no proper remuneration. The time to be a school teacher is not when everybody else decides to be a school teacher. This is what happened in the early 60s. And we had so many who wanted to change the world and improve the world, and they went into teaching. And there were no opportunities for them all. And so many wasted their time. And often those who stayed in afterward wished they hadn't been in the area. Now, of course, we have a real shortage of skilled teachers at certain levels. This is now essentially a quarter of a century later. The time to have studied for being a teacher is when most people thought this wasn't the time to study and started to go in another direction. Because you would see that finally you would be at that point in time when the need would arise for you. And those who had been in it and soured didn't want to go back, and those who never continued had already gotten interested in something else. So you should read these proverbs, but realize that very often they only apply to the general matter of character in whatever occupation you have, but they don't necessarily tell you what occupation you have or whether you should remain in it. And this is where creativity is very important, the kind that Joseph saw. He saw it was a lot better to work for Pharaoh than it was for his former employer. And he could also see what that might mean in terms of the dreams he had had, you remember. Verse 5, he that gathers in summer is a wise son. That is, you work when the opportunity comes. Summer in the northern hemisphere was that time when harvest was the way to make money, because there is a time when there is no harvesting. You don't want to lose the income from the previous month's work. M-O-N-T-H-S apostrophe. He that sleeps at harvest is a son that causes shame. So it is very important to realize when opportunity comes, use it. That's what this is telling us. When opportunity comes, use it, whether it is small or great. Now, let's turn to some other aspects here that might be of some help. Chapter 11, verse 15. He that is surety for a stranger shall smart for it. He that hates surety is secure. That is where, in a sense, you either give your money to somebody else, hoping that it will be paid back because you need it back, or where you promise to pay somebody else's debts. It is very important that when you enter into an agreement with anybody else, that you correctly assess the situation. Great damage can be done by people who have provided their money for somebody else. And the somebody else who has none but has the ideas is usually the one who, if he had had better ideas, would have had the money in the first place and probably doesn't have successful ideas presently. Probably. That's just a point of wisdom. Unfortunately, most people in the church who have money have forgotten another worldly proverb, money talks. And they've let the person who didn't have it talk. It's very important that if you have this capital resource, that you have some understanding as to how it will be used. Or keep it in your own jurisdiction. There's another nice principle laid out in 24. I'm reading, by the way, from the revised version. I just happened to have it at the table this evening. I thought it's sometimes nice to read a slightly different one. It's very near the authorized, but a little more modern in a few places. There is that scattereth, or that is one who does, and yet increases more. There's one who withholds more than is proper. And he thinks he has therefore retained something, but in the end, it tends only to want, in his case. So the liberal soul will be made fat. This is talking about generosity. The word liberal originally meant generous, not permissive. It's very important that you realize that in a job, that you do your best. Or whenever there is a need, that you do help others when the need is genuine. Don't curse yourself by helping a rich man. That's foolish. I mean, even he will think you're foolish. But don't withhold in order for you to profit by taking advantage of someone else. One can say, I think Mr. Armstrong was generous to a fault. He said so himself. He was very generous. The one thing he never did was to withhold what he thought was certainly something that might help someone else. It's sometimes wise to know how far to go and no further. But it's always better, let's say, to scatter mean that you help here, you help there. And what seems to be a loss when you do that turns out to be a gain. These principles apply in any area, but also they must be tempered with wisdom. When you are responsible for managing yours or somebody else's money, you must know that you are not, in fact, allowing money that is essential for the business to be diverted to generosity somewhere else, which does not make sense for the good of what business you're in. Now there is another verse, chapter 12, verse 11. I'm just picking out a few. There's some in between that would be of help. He that tills his land shall have plenty of bread, but he that follows after vain persons is devoid of understanding. Now, it's quite all right if you till your land and you have plenty of bread. That means you must work at it. You must work at it. You remember the old story of the fellow who was told that if he found what was buried in the soil, why, he would become a prosperous person, and he dug and dug, and, you know, he simply turned up all the soil, and he never found it, so he planted it, and it produced a marvelous crop. That was where the wealth was. He had to work at it. Now, today, of course, you must do it, but not with all this high-cost borrowed money. But the point of verse 11, the last half, is what I draw to your attention. He that follows after vain persons is devoid of understanding. That is, people who come up with vain ideas, simply that will never succeed. So easy for a person who doesn't have money to have the right idea, and they come to the person who has it. Don't ever let that kind of thing take place. But that kind of thing does take place in and out of the church. The proverb here says to beware. Simply better to manage your own money. Now, if somebody has a good idea and he has also handled his money properly, well, that might be a little better. He's given a little more proof. Mr. Armstrong saw this problem many years ago as one of the great difficulties, and he felt it was always better not to get involved in loaning. If you have to help somebody in need, make it a gift. Chapter 13, verse 7. There is that, or one who, makes himself rich, yet has nothing. He that makes himself poor, yet has great wealth. You know, there are people who are constantly borrowing from somebody else and appear to be rich, but they really have nothing. And there are those who are helping others and don't appear to have that much because they're helping others, and yet they're accumulating, and I'm not talking about in another realm in the world tomorrow or in heaven. Some reward. I'm talking about even in this life. Because if a man is careful enough to have enough to give away, he is also, therefore, having a solid base from which that money that is given to help others comes from. But if a person quickly seems to be rich by having borrowed, he will soon discover that he has nothing. There were many letters in circulation in 77, 78, 79. And you were told to leverage up and leverage up and leverage up. And you had so much title and so many debts. And that was before interest suddenly rose sky high. At which point, you couldn't sell what you had acquired, because nobody could borrow at any reasonable rate to buy what you had. You'll notice that such statements no longer appear in the mail. And people who made those statements no longer have public lectures. So it is important to take note that you don't suddenly try to become rich on other people's money. Now, there is a time to make use of other people's money, but you must know what you're doing, and your motive should never be just to get rich quicker, but rather to be able to help others and to be practical and always concerned for the person from whom such funds would be borrowed. In this case, a bank or savings and loan, whatever. That's the right approach. Verse 18, the same chapter. Poverty and shame shall be to him who refuses correction. The footnote for that is instruction, not necessarily correction, in the sense that we think of for children. Instruction, poverty and shame to him who refuses instruction. So here we do learn that it is important to be made wise by the instruction of others. You want to listen to others' experience. It pays to pay attention to what other people have learned. And then you will know whether you should go ahead and do what you were planning. If you don't pay attention, you may make the same mistakes the other person did. Verse 22 says, a good man leaves an inheritance to his children's children, that is, to his grandchildren. Now, that is a solidly good principle, that we don't neglect our family responsibilities. That means we give our children or our grandchildren, in this particular case, opportunities to succeed. A good man leaves an inheritance to his grandchildren is not the example of a man who gets a girl pregnant and doesn't even care for his children, much less his grandchildren. That's the way it is, you know, in now much of the world. 20 to 25% in the white community and 50% in the black community in this country are born of men who don't even think of leaving an inheritance, much less to their children's children. Now, you can't be successful in life for the family or successful for the church unless you take an approach such as this and make it fundamental. The reason the Church of God today is succeeding as well as it has, is that no small part of the growth of the church today, not a decade ago, but today, is coming from young people who were reared correctly, who have learned responsibility, who have married successfully, who now themselves make a contribution to the church. There are always people who are listening to the broadcast, reading our publications, who are also coming in. But no small part today is coming from the result of good parenting. And that goes hand in hand with successful job responsibility. And of course, when grandchildren come along, what a marvelous opportunity to give them a chance to succeed where, let's say, maybe you didn't have. It was much more difficult for you to succeed when you were young. In this case, you give grandchildren an opportunity. Now remember, this doesn't mean we spoil them. They always should learn how to earn money, how to have a good job, and how to succeed at what they do. But to give opportunity so they don't have to spend their time at some things and may proceed with others. That's one of the great gifts that we as parents or grandparents can give. 15, chapter 15, verse 16. Better is little with the fear of the Lord than great treasure and trouble therewith. Now, this, of course, pertains to the human relationship. We're familiar with that. The next mention is better to have a dinner of herbs where love is than a stalled ox and hate. Many aspects here are general. But we'll just say by picking one, and you can read some more, you discover that you can try to accumulate a lot of money, and there are all sorts of troubles keeping it. It's sometimes simply better to have a little. There are many farmers, they're gifted, they're able, and they're not expected to do more than they can. They have a little. They have a fear of God. They do what is right. They didn't get into trouble and seem to be wealthy by buying up new lands with borrowed money. And then came the trouble to pay off the debts, you see. So what may be here typical of any aspect of life to which this can apply, here is a proverb, most certainly, that farmers as a whole in this country paid no attention to beginning roughly in 1972 on until it was too late. Better to have the old paid-for tractor. Better to have the smaller property paid for. Many people made serious mistakes in other areas of expanding too late. Never want to take the risk of that. It's better to stay a little smaller than to lose too much. Let's move now to chapter 16. Verse 16, another interesting thought here. How much better it is to get wisdom than gold, yet to get understanding is rather to be chosen than silver. Now, in some ways, the word wisdom is used here throughout the book without significant definition. And I want to draw attention to the fact that wisdom is, as you go along, taken for granted as understood by the reader. That is, to be able to make wise decisions. It is very important, therefore, to know when it comes to our being successful contributors to the work, that we have the wisdom to make right decisions. And we don't put first the mere selfish coveting of money. That's very important. In the long run, that's not the way to go. To try to make money quick, to try to focus on money itself, whether gold or silver, is not the way to go. A man long since dead, Mr. Henyon, who used to be on the board of trustees of the Church of God in Oregon, was a man who never set his heart on gold or silver, but set it on wisdom. And Mr. Armstrong cited his example many times in the earlier years of the college. He told Mr. Armstrong on one occasion, he said, "You know, I don't give quite as much as some others or as much as I would be able to in any one year." But he said, "You know, Mr. Armstrong, I've been giving more each year in the Depression. How come I can give more each year?" The answer is, I don't give more than I can afford to give. And I set aside a certain amount which enables me to have a better base to make more money for the work next year. I could give it all this year and I wouldn't have it to work with for next year. So the choice of wisdom to know how to make right decisions in the use of time, money, talent, and friendships, contact, that is very important. That's the most important. The gold will come as a result. But you don't seek it in terms of gold or silver. So it's very important that we make wise choices. And these wise choices in the long run will produce either the gold or silver, which the work can use, the family can use, as well as, of course, that which is even more valuable, the spiritual wisdom and understanding overall in life. But it's important that you learn to make right decisions and not merely try to get ahead too quickly. Mr. Armstrong told you in the autobiography that he could have taken one route which would have given him a quick opportunity and it essentially would have been a dead-end job. Or he could take the job that was smaller. You know, writing the want ads, which gave less result, less gold, less silver. But there was a lot of wisdom and understanding to be learned in writing those want ads and dealing with people. Learning the little thing, how to write a little ad before you write a bigger one. And in the end, of course, he was simply better trained. So you don't always want to measure it on the basis of immediate remuneration. Now I have another verse in chapter 18, 22, verse 22. Whoever finds a wife finds a good thing and obtains favor of the Eternal. Whoever finds a wife finds a good thing. Most people today have only lovers. A wife is someone who is actually a wife. Someone who is actually a wife, as God defines. And if there is a problem, certainly many men, or it could be the reverse, the women who they have a man they're living with, but they don't really have a husband. To have the right mate means that you really do have God's favor and that you have found someone who can be of help at very critical periods of time. Now turn a page and you come to chapter 19, verse 14, a very interesting parallel. House and riches are an inheritance from fathers or grandfathers, but a prudent wife is from God. Now, this implies that you can work at the accumulation of goods and present it to your children or your grandchildren. But the best thing is to trust God to find a prudent mate and not just your wisdom. In a sense, your wisdom, your understanding, your skills can enable you to pay for house or home and to accumulate sufficient monies to be able to leave your children and grandchildren so they can become more successful. Those are the things you can put your mind to. But perhaps what this is telling us is all that could be undone if you simply marry an imprudent woman. Or vice versa. A woman who inherits from her father and marries an imprudent man who spends it on alcohol, beer, whatever, or gambling. It works both ways. So from these two verses in 18:22 and 19:14, we have some very important implications that there are some things you can do and there are other things God provides. You have to use judgment. But if you really trust God, he can bring the person into your life whom you would never have thought to have met before. My wife and I yesterday evening, I think, could say that two of the ministers are here whom we knew from the earliest years of their college life. From their judgment, they have both married successfully, and I trust that the women think the same. But I can say that I think they both left it to God to find a way to bring to their attention the right person. Now, before we leave this evening, there is something that could undo everything you learn. Wine is a mocker and strong drink a brawler, and whoever errs thereby is not wise. How much is undone by the abuse of alcohol? Your reputation, your money, your family can all be seriously damaged. You must never neglect that in terms of the development of your service. One last one that seems appropriate for this occasion. The rich rules over the poor. The borrower is servant to the lender. There is a time to capitalize on someone else's money. But you want to follow advice of a church member who said long ago, if you want to take a little risk, and there are people who can successfully do so, always be sure that you don't put everything you have at risk. You just take something and put it at risk. Hence the old statement, don't put all your eggs in one basket, because when you stumble and the basket tips over and all the eggs go out, they're all gone. But if you have two baskets and you happen to have struck something with one, you have them all in the other. You know, that's the meaning of the proverb. So it's very important that you never put more than a minimum at risk. There is a time, in other words, that I can see, and we've always understood that, to perhaps to borrow. And in that area, you are a servant to the lender. And then you pay it off, and then you're like the person who is in charge. But never let it get out of hand. So much so that you put your home and your family at risk. Never take needless chances in the development of your, let's say, the monies that come from your wages, your salary, or your business. Now, there's much more that can be done. I don't think the ministry is in the capacity to be what we would call business counselors, financial counselors, in any sense of the word. But the Bible does counsel on many of these broad examples here, and you can learn to apply it. You have wonderful public libraries to go to. You have friendships to capitalize on. So let's make good use of our time in the foreseeable future. The foreseeable future.